Trashlinie presenteert. In samenwerking met Recto Verso, Gonzo Circus en Collateral. Radicaal geroezemoes. Een sonische verkenning in drie delen. Aflevering 1. De sonische stad. We leven in een mediatijdperk dat gedomineerd wordt door beeld en taal en waarin geluid vaak minder belangrijk lijkt. Trashlinie gaat op zoek naar de mogelijkheden van de sonische dimensie aan de hand van gesprekken met makers en denkers die vertrekken vanuit geluid. Wat kunnen we over de wereld te weten komen door te luisteren? Wat zijn de politieke en artistieke mogelijkheden van geluid? En wat kan een sonische sensibiliteit betekenen voor ons denken en handelen? In drie afleveringen verkennen we deze sonische wereld met interviews op locatie, waarin het rumoer en geroezemoes van de omgeving nadrukkelijk ook een stem hebben. In deze eerste episode, de sonische stad, leggen we ons oor te luister in de stedelijke omgeving. Onze eerste ontmoeting is met denker en kunstenaar Salome Voegelin in Berlijn. Voegelin schreef een aantal baanbrekende boeken in het domein van de sound studies, waaronder The Political Possibility of Sound en Sonic Possible Worlds. Zij is bij uitstek de persoon die ons kan vertellen over sonic sensibility en wat de politieke mogelijkheden van geluid zijn. We treffen haar in januari en doen wat zoveel mensen in de afgelopen jaren tijdens lockdowns hebben gedaan. We maken een wandeling. Het gaat meteen flink bergop. Vandaar dat we soms naar adem happen.
So would you like me, now that we're a bit away from the trains, maybe say something about, introduce myself. So my name is Salome Voegelin. I am originally a Swiss and then for a very long time now, 25, 27 years, resident in England and now since 2 years or 1.5 years in Berlin. Sound artist, researcher, writer into sound as a material. I mean, there is an interest in sound art, an interest in music, of course, as well, and in so the materiality of sound, also the materiality of sound in the everyday, how we hear ourselves, how we move and behave and orientate ourselves in the everyday because of the sounds we hear, even though we might not even be aware of it. So as a kind of social, cultural studies, if you will, but also as a conceptual thinking art and thinking the everyday through sound, through its relationality, how sound is not this or that, but how it is always about relationships and in between spaces and in between times, that allows us, I feel, to rethink norms, habits, how we normally move, how we normally act and react. It just gives us sort of another layer in which to think about ourselves as subjects, as identities, and to think about the world and the environments as organized. They're always organized, they're always constructed, racially, gender, class, organizes the world differently. And sound, I'm so intrigued by it, or I love to work with it, because it allows us to step out a little bit of this visual preference and see another world, a sonic possible world through which we can reflect what we think we see and what we think we know. So I work on that sort of intrigue and excitement through writing, through work and teaching, and yeah, in all sorts of ways.
We zijn in Volkspark Humboldtshain en we klimmen een van de kunstmatige bergen die daar uit het bijeengeveegde schroot van de Tweede Wereldoorlog rond twee gigantische nazi-bunkers zijn opgetrokken.
I think sound is such a relational medium. It's, you really want to do it together. You want to play music together. You want to make sounds together. You want to discuss sounds together. That's a real strong impulse for me.
Yeah, you want to hear and to be heard.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's about reciprocity, and it's not just about a one-way stream, but it's also not just about listening. It's about the exchange, because the sounds really are, and you can't see this on a radio program, but they're not over there and they're not with my body, but they're somewhere in this invisible space in between, and they're indivisible. We might think, well, you're a different person from me, and we're individuated shapes and forms, have nothing to do with each other, we stop with our skin. But as soon as we get into conversation, we become entangled, and our entanglement and codependence becomes apparent, and we are indivisible. The exclusion of sound in philosophical discourse, or in theory in general, and we're talking Western discourse here and Western philosophy, is not innocent. I mean, the Western thought is all about tidying up the world along lines of function, purpose to the human. Very anthropocentric, hence also this, the colonial grab, the kind of grabbing, taking and bringing into museums where it then gets ordered. Absolutely, behind glass cabinets, and it's a totally visual culture that is not just visual because it's just forgot about the sonic, but because the sonic, in its non-categorizability, in its non-linearity, it's in its diffuse geography and in its diffuse history, disturbs that ideology of clear individuation, clear identity. This country, not that country, this bird, not that bird, where it doesn't, for the visual to work as a philosophy, it needs to exclude that fuzzy, what it calls irrational indivisibility of sound. Because as soon as we think through whatever discipline you take, literature, geography, history, music, particularly music that really doesn't like sound, paradoxically speaking, because it likes organized sound. Mm. It likes a tone. It likes a categorizable, linguistically organizable sound. Then you disturb the kind of fundamentals of science of that discipline and how it's been rationalized and its logic. And hidden behind that logic and rationality is, of course, a politics. It's a colonial politics. It's a politics of a knowledge that is supreme, that also perceives itself as universal, as a scientism. And so my interest in sound is because I think it holds an awful lot of alternative knowledge, of extra knowledge, of plural knowledge that we desperately need to actually solve problems like climate change and the health issues brought on by COVID. Because these are problems of indivisibility. These are problems of codependence and correlation, that we are one world, that is one cosmos, and everything somebody does on this side of the world will have an impact on this side. What you do has an impact on me. We're not individuated Western forms. We are entirely formless, and if we want to solve these problems, we need a sonic sensibility to at least play part, to at least be a collaborator in our thinking and knowledge production. I'm interested in sound because I understand it as a greater malaise, or its exclusion is an exclusion of everything that's off the line, everything that's not white, masculine, straight, Western thinking, all the fuzzy bits. And we can only get to those other things, or sound is one way, one portal, to get to those funny things and be able to bring them to and with to pluralize knowledge, to have tacit knowledge, feminist knowledge, local knowledge, material knowledge, that can all start, maybe, if we could abandon the line, work together.
We zijn boven aangekomen en staan op een van de bunkers. Een zogenaamde vlakturm. Die werd gebouwd voor de luchtafweer en die nu dienst doet als uitkijktoren. Deze omgeving ademt de Berlijnse geschiedenis. Zijn er sonische manieren om de stedelijke geschiedenis te benaderen in plaats van de gangbare visuele manier?
Yeah, I find it interesting because we're still standing on this vlakturm.
Vlakturm, yeah.
That's what it said downstairs.
Probably.
And so it's obviously a tower that was somehow built to look far away to see whether the enemy is coming. That,
true.
I imagine that that's what it was built for, and it still has that sense. So we're standing here and we can actually see far into Pankow and beyond. And that is the kind of the visual cartography and the visual sensibility is about this sense of I am not involved in what I see. I can have an objective science, a Wissenschaft, a science, because my body, my physical whatever does not influence what I see. So this is a huge fiction, a huge illusion. I mean, it's almost fantastical how the visual is completely built on an impossibility. On an impossibility that my gaze is not involved also as a subjectivity in what I see, however at a distance I am. But I think it's built into this space that this space means I am not influencing. And that's why you can do cartography. You can draw lines on a piece of paper and call it a map and think you can get the measure of a country, or you can get the measure of an area, and authority and credibility comes out of that space, and evidence and an authority to evidence and reference, which is really interesting to me in terms of how knowledge is produced and how knowledge, some knowledge can be made legitimate because we can evidence it, we can reference it, we can refer back to historically, oh, this person said this and this person said that. But then, of course, the question, particularly if I come from Masonic thinking, well, what if I'm not in history? What if my identity is not represented? What if history doesn't tell my story? How do I reference my contemporary at this moment reality? How do I evidence that I even exist now? And how could I write a paper without past references if the past references do not hold my knowledge? And that's kind of a really basic question of how we can decolonialize knowledge, because we'd really have to stop being, and this is particularly since I live in Germany, something I've realized, the Germans are extremely, the reference to the past and the doing of Wissenschaft as a scholarship of the past into the present is really, really essential here. You really get your legitimacy through that movement. And obviously decoloniality would mean that movement cannot be made, because if I'm not in history books, how can my knowledge of the present be truthful or right? I can't evidence it, I can't reference it. And again, I'm probably losing your question, but I think so, the closeness into which sound always and by necessity throws us. There is no distance. We're standing about COVID properly 1.5 meters apart, but of course we are not in sounds that apart. I really sense you. I think about your question. I hear your voice. I feel your voice. I have to deal with its full materiality and don't just answer the question semantically, but also the intonation, the sense I get from it and everything else. And that is far more complex. It's a far more complex way. But I think there's something held in that. There is something held in if we don't just refer back to a historical line. But then we can't make maps, and we have to rethink what history is, that we do it as histories at best, or maybe just very fuzzy stories, that the autobiographical has much more sway. My reality as an individual reality that then meets your reality in negotiation has to hold scholarly, scientific sway. Science has to become a matter of negotiation, particularly in the humanities, where we negotiate how we can speak about things and whose voice counts and what we can and how we can learn from each other rather than maybe from a historical moment. And so I think the closeness of sound just really challenges us in new ways, but because we can't physically, we can't remove ourselves, so we have to deal with that closeness and proximity as a methodology rather than as something we need to avoid.
Listen to the traffic. Hear its rhythm with the rhythm of your breath. To understand how you relate. Listen to a movement. Listen again. Connect it with your body. Listen to the loudest sound you can hear. Whisper it silently. Sound it quietly. Shout louder. Listen to a sound you are not sure you can hear. Walk towards it, humming its rhythm all the while. When you are sure you can hear it, break into a cannon. Listen to a sound that you like. Stay with it. Sound it to try to understand your like. Continue it until you love it. Vanaf de hoge vlakturm kijken we uit over de stad. Betekent Voegelin's pleidooi voor sonische sensibiliteit ook dat er een teveel aan visuele sensibiliteit is? Is er op de een of andere manier iets mis met het prachtige panorama? Moeten we wantrouwen wat we zien?
I like it. I like views. I have absolutely nothing against views. But it also always interests me, you know, we sort of part of my maybe advocacy for sound studies is always, well, actually, you know, we have had already sound studies in the 60s and 70s. If you think of something like Michel Desserteau and his book of, you know, the spatial practices, or the, where he goes to the World Trade Center and he discusses New York as seen from the World Trade Center and as seen by the walker down below. This kind of very seminal text, and to me, although of course he never mentions sound at all, but he mentions the blind walker, the person who walks in the streets, who makes a path, who can't see from one house to the next, because obviously in New York they're very high and you haven't got a horizon, as opposed to the, like we are now on top of this Flakturm. When you're high above and you can see, you have this, what he calls the godlike view. Yes. And this godlike view that suffuses also the notion of science as the those who know as being clearer to God. Yeah, that you are, there's a certain control implied. But it's nice because when you listen to this, obviously when you hear us talking and walking through this environment on the radio, you can't see what we see. This vista from afar, the control we have over the design of the place of Berlin, looking northwards towards Pankow. All you get is this kind of really intense a siren, a train in your ear, on your body. Yeah, yes.
And it's also interesting that in a sense it does mirror. We're seeing, in the sense that it's not a few sounds that not in our world, but it's everything. It's the simultaneous amalgam of all these different things happening and these things that make sounds.
Exactly, and we can't order them, we can't organize them. The way we do now, I stand here and I see how the cars are going right, the two police cars went right, their cars going left. I have a mapped vision and I'm organizing the world, I'm ordering the world. And in sound, I can't do that. If it gets thrown to me by the radio, it's just like, oh my God, there's so much happening. But actually, it's exactly this disorder, this unorganized, this unmapped, that I think is a very interesting challenge for listening, to build your own way that these things connect. You're in a way you connect to the sound of police sirens or to an S-Bahn or to maybe you've been here before, and so there is a memory that comes into play, whether you like the birds we're hearing as well or not. And you have to sort of make a contingent sense of all the things you hear together rather than being presented with how the world is.
Het hartstochtelijke pleidooi voor sonische sensibiliteit van Voegelin galmt na in onze hoofden en vermengt zich met het stadsgemoer. Volgens Voegelin is sonische sensibiliteit een manier om de wereld te benaderen die de onzichtbare bewegingen onder het oppervlak van een visuele wereld blootlegt en daardoor de dominante positie van die visuele wereld uitdaagt. Een uitzicht vanaf een hoog gebouw mag dan prachtig zijn. Tegelijk biedt het goddelijke perspectief een valse schijn van overzicht, helderheid en afstand, waardoor een persoon of zelfs een gehele cultuur zich zogenaamd objectief, maar eigenlijk superieur kan gaan wanen. Sonische sensibiliteit biedt daarin een tegenwicht. De bewustwording van de complexe, polyfone sonische wereld, waar we niet op objectieve afstand van staan, maar juist middenin, maakt het goddelijke, superieure perspectief onmogelijk. Zo realiseren we ons dat we deze prachtige, pluriforme complexiteit moeten omarmen, deze sonische dimensie kunnen ontsluiten door te luisteren en zo tot andere, mogelijke werelden kunnen komen. Sonic Possible Worlds. We spitsen onze oren en concentreren ons op deze onzichtbare ruimte. Het gigantische weefsel van klanken dat om en door ons heen beweegt. Langzaam beginnen de Sonic Possible Worlds tot ons door te dringen. We blijven nog even in Berlijn en stappen in de metro om field recordist en muzikant Peter Cusack te treffen in een zogenaamde Hinterhof in de buurt rond de Hackescher Markt. Cusack begon in 1998 het project Favorite Sounds, waarin wordt onderzocht wat mensen positief vinden aan de soundscapes van de plekken waar ze leven. Het project heeft wereldwijd plaatsgevonden in onder meer Londen, Beijing, Praag, Manchester en Berlijn. Een ander langlopend project beschrijft Cusack zelf als sonische journalistiek. Het heet Sounds from Dangerous Places en onderzoekt de soundscapes van plekken waar ecologische catastrofes hebben plaatsgevonden. Zoals Tsjernobyl, de Kaspische olievelden en het Białowieża-bos in Polen.
Liebe Fahrgäste, im ÖPNV gilt die 3G-Regel. Beachten Sie die gesetzlichen Regelungen zur Maskenpflicht. Wir empfehlen das Tragen einer FFP2-Maske. Vielen Dank.
My name is Peter Cusack. I'm a field recordist and a musician and sometimes a sound artist and also a teacher, lecturer in sound. I do have done many projects over the years to do with mine and human relationships with our sound environment, both in urban and rural and in distant lands. Well, we are in the center of Berlin, Berlin Mitte, and outside the Father Carpenter Cafe, and that is inside a Berlin Hinterhof, a kind of courtyard, which is a very big part of Berlin architecture. The courtyards are usually surrounded on all sides by buildings, and maybe there's an entrance, as here, an archway out to the street, but sometimes there's even a door protecting that. So it's a kind of architecture which prevents the city noise coming in inside the courtyards, and so they're much quieter. But because they're surrounded by buildings, they also are rather reverberant. Mm. So if I clap my hands, you hear the reverberation of that sound rather easily. And that, of course, depends on how big it is and how high the buildings are and whether it's a hard surface. Many Berlin Hinterhofs have actually a garden inside, so there are trees and grass and often birds singing. But this has some ornamental garden, but nothing wild or particularly large. I mean, Berlin is a young city compared to most capital cities in Europe. It was built at the end of the 19th century. At that time, it was not an industrial city, well, it never has been. But there is a lot of small industry. And so the Hinterhöfe used to be places where people would live and then they would have their small workplace on the ground, or maybe even keep animals. So maybe at the beginning of the last century, these places were full of noise, working noise, and people would live on the higher stories. Today, all that's changed. Now most of them have become entirely residential. But in the center of the city, as we are now, those workplaces have become cafes or restaurants or IT companies or, you know, the usual new industries, which of course are much quieter than a blacksmith or a cleaning factory. So they're relatively quiet. And you can hear the birds singing. Here we have a pigeon calling almost constantly. It's coming on for springtime, so they're already busy looking for mates and marking out nesting places. And that's what you can hear. Pigeons are very common in Berlin Hinterhof. And the other main sound is the traffic noise coming in from the streets. But that, again, is rather quiet.
What is your favorite sound of the city you live in, and why? Is de vraag die Peter Cusack al sinds 1998 aan stadsbewoners stelt in het kader van zijn project Favorite Sounds. Zelf schrijft hij hierover dat dit weliswaar een simpele vraag is, maar dat het niet zo eenvoudig is om een antwoord te geven. Cusack probeert via het project erachter te komen hoe we interacteren met de geluiden van de steden en buurten waarin we leven en werken. De antwoorden tonen de stad van het oor in plaats die van het oog en benadrukken alle rollen die geluid speelt in het dagelijks leven. Het activeren van herinneringen, de associaties met andere gedachten, het in gang zetten van handelingen, het geven van genot en de constante informatie die geluid geeft over de gebeurtenissen die om ons heen gebeuren. Heeft Berlijn eigenlijk een uniek geluid? Of klinkt het hetzelfde als andere steden van vergelijkbare omvang?
Yes, I think all cities have a unique sound, in fact. I mean, what that actually is and the reasons for it are often very complicated. And it's to do with the transport infrastructure and the styles of architecture, how much green space, how high or low the buildings are, and then also the geographical location. If you compare Berlin with an Italian city, for example, the weather there is much warmer generally, and therefore the the wildlife. There are kind of constantly insects chirping in Italy. You don't hear that. You hear that in the summer in Berlin. Also, the people's kind of style of behaviour is different from one country to another. In Italy, again, they're very keen on going for a walk around in the end of the afternoon, early evening, kind of promenading around. You don't do that in Berlin. It's too cold. So the geographical position has a huge difference on the wildlife and on how people behave and on the styles of architecture, because, again, the more north you go, the architecture has to be built for the winter in a way that in southern Europe, it's not necessary. All that makes a big difference to how a place sounds.
Tijdens deze ontmoeting met Cusack wordt duidelijk wat de sonische sensibiliteit van Voegelin kan betekenen. De gevoeligheid voor en de kennis over de omringende klankwereld die Cusack tentoonspreidt is inspirerend en indrukwekkend. De Flakturm en nu dit Hinterhof. Alles in Berlijn lijkt geschiedenis te ademen. Berlijn is in de 20e eeuw regelmatig het toneel geweest van belangrijke gebeurtenissen in de Europese historie. Bestaat er ook zoiets als een historisch geluidsspoor? Resoneert het verleden in de stad van het heden?
Yes, I would say for sure. For example, Berlin was a divided city from the end of the Second World War until 1989. So there was a lot of development which still exists that happened when it was East Berlin or West Berlin, when they were separate. And you can hear that. For example, in East Berlin, they use paving stones, which are bigger than in West Berlin. So, and some of those areas still exist. So if you drag a suitcase with wheels across, the rhythm is different in East Berlin compared to West Berlin. Mm. Also, different people came. In West Berlin and West Germany in general, the guest workers were mostly Turkish or Greek.
And in the East,
it was Vietnamese. So again, that still is it's beginning to mix up much more now, but you still find more Vietnamese language spoken in the East than in the West, and more Turkish in former West. There are more trams in former East. So yes, there are quite a lot of, they're small things, but they make, when you add them together, a noticeable difference. Yeah, I mean, Berlin's unique. Most modern cities have a very unclear dividing line at the point where the city ends. They sprawl for many kilometers through suburbs and then... But Berlin, actually, because of its history, has very sharp points where it's the city ends and the countryside starts. And actually, you can find those in both East and West. But that is something that makes Berlin slightly different from other European cities.
The sort of parts break between urban and rural.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's beginning to change. But the East German planning regulations were much tighter about where you could build and where you could not build. But in West Berlin, there was a border. So, of course, they couldn't build outside the border. So for different reasons, there was quite a kind of sharp end to the city on that side as well. But Berlin has no high buildings. I mean, there are one or two. But compared to London or Paris or Brussels, the the height of the buildings in Berlin is very, it's quite low. And that makes a difference to the way the acoustics works. It makes a difference to the way the wind blows through the city, which has an effect on the soundscape.
What makes Berlin sound particularly Berlin? Is it more subdued, or is it?
No, I think Berlin is certainly quieter than Brussels. In Brussels, you hear many sirens a lot of the time. Of course, you hear them in Berlin also, but not nearly as much. Berlin does not have so many aircraft flying over. Brussels has a lot. London is constantly covered with air. Well, until the pandemic, it was constantly covered with aeroplanes. So Paris has much less green space. Berlin has a lot of green space. So it's actually full of wildlife. Non-human presence is quite high in Berlin compared to other cities. There are particularly unique things in Berlin. For example, the S-Bahn railway system has a very special sound. And because it's very extensive, it was actually during the time of East Germany, it was run by the East Germans, even though it operates also in West Berlin. It's very extensive, and wherever you are in Berlin, you hear the S-Bahn, and that has a really or rising tones. This is quite a musical contribution to Berlin's soundscape, which is totally unique to Berlin. Oh, Berlin is also the nightingale capital of Europe.
Is it?
So there are many nightingales that you hear at the right time of year, which is kind of April, May, singing in Berlin, maybe 3,000.
Wow.
All European capitals have a few, but Berlin has many. So at that time of year, whenever you walk out, particularly at night, you hear these fantastic songbirds. Another common favourite sound is the sound of different green spaces like parks or gardens or cemeteries. So in the Favourite Sounds project, the two biggest categories in most cities are either green spaces or public transport sounds, but then there are many others as well.
The quieter sounds, or rather not at all.
Some people often like loud sounds, particularly loud sounds on that are short. I mean, there are people that like traffic noise. I was surprised to find that, but it is so. So you can never tell. Everybody is different.
Right.
And so the idea that you would find a popular sound and then have much of that and everybody would be happy is total nonsense.
Right. That's the wish of city planners.
Yes, that's right. I mean, for me, the way that project translates into planning ideas is that you need as big a variety of sounds as possible. and some everybody will find some to hate, and everybody will find some to like. And that would be my aim, which is a shame, because normally planning now tries to make everything conform to the same few standards, and that makes everything boring.
Mm. Right. Yeah. So would you be able to tell from a field recording if it's in a let's say a redevelopment area with lots of new buildings, because of these sound measures that are being imposed everywhere and are the same everywhere?
Not really. I don't think just by listening to a recording you'd be able to tell that there was a difference, but you wouldn't necessarily be able to be accurate about it just from the sound. I mean, the way we perceive things is that, I mean, right now we're just talking about sound, but in fact our eyes are working, all our senses are working. So we don't only hear, we see what we hear, we hear what we see, smell, the temperature, all of that. Here's an S-Bahn. Here it has a kind of tone to it, which is quite nice.
It is.
And when it slows down, that goes downwards, and when it speeds up, the tone rises, so it kind of has a glissando. Now, I mean, our senses all work together, so it's quite false to concentrate only on sound or only on vision. This is another S-Bahn. And so it's hard to separate the information, because in normal life we do not. We need all, our perception is from all the senses all of the time. So you can't necessarily get all the information just by listening or just by seeing or just by anything. You need together.
We reizen terug naar Nederland. In Den Haag ontmoeten we kunstenaar Justin Bennett in het gebouwencomplex New Babylon, pal naast het Centraal Station. Bennett heeft binnen en rondom dit gebouw het audioproject Radio New Babylon opgezet. New Babylon is vernoemd naar het geesteskind van kunstenaar Constant Nieuwenhuis, een utopische, anticapitalistische stad waar de homo ludens, de spelende mens, centraal staat. De mens heeft in deze stad van Nieuwenhuis de vrijheid om te spelen en te creëren, omdat door de automatisering conventionele arbeid overbodig is geworden. Het complex New Babylon, waar we Bennett treffen, ademt echter zeker geen anti-kapitalistische sfeer uit.
So I'm Justin Bennett. I live in Den Haag, in the Netherlands. That's where we are now. And I'm an artist, I guess. I work with sound and image in different ways. And I'm very interested in the cities and in architecture, and in the way that the sound of our environment in the cities, how it affects us and our life, and how people behave and that kind of thing. And now we're in New Babylon, which is it's a kind of office and residential complex next to the Central Station. And we're on the ground floor, which is really the only publicly accessible part of the space. It's not a public space, but it's we can walk through it. It's mostly empty at the moment. There are one or two shops. But I think, as you can hear, it's quite a quiet place, really.
sounds are very low.
Yeah, especially in this position, because you can hear people coming and going, and it sort of moves through the space in an interesting way.
What's the precise history of the building again? Was it a sort of a story of failure and vacant spaces?
When I first moved to The Hague, it was quite a busy place because it was the place you went to from Central Station to have something to eat or have coffee or something. So it was kind of that proximity to the station made it quite lively. But I think it was always troubled. If you look at the history of the building, it's been sold and bought many, many times, and sometimes for not much money, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's been kind of shoved between investment vehicles, taken over by the state and then sold off again and all this kind of thing. And it's been going on and on for a long time.
And then now it's in private hands?
Now it's in private hands. It's actually, at the moment, I think, owned by a Danish pension fund. Uh-huh. It was originally offices, and now I think you can see, if we look up there, that is the apartment block, I think, that you can see towering above us. And there's another tower here, which is offices. So the only public space, I mean, it's not even a public space, but this sort of public space we're in is just the ground floor. When the renovation first took place, there were cafes and restaurants and shops on two floors. But quite a lot of the people, they left because the rents were too high, basically. Yeah. So it was... I don't know. There was a lot of protest from the people there. I find it quite an interesting space, just as an empty space, because it has an interesting acoustic. I think it's very reverberant, really, because of these glass walls. And it's quite quiet, you also have these visual reflections. So visually, it's quite strong. It's not my favorite sort of architecture, and it could be a bit kitschy or something. But actually, these circles, they work really well as a kind of visual element that goes through the building. So I don't think it's all disastrous or negative, but it's just mostly the kind of idea about it being to think about it as being a kind of the end result of constant Neuenhaus's trajectory through New Babylon, and it ends up as this. Of course, they would say, no, it used to be called Babylon, this building. And so it has nothing to do with constant Neuenhaus, it's just the new Babylon.
But even Babylon is quite weird and sort of almost a setup for failure, one could say, to name your fancy new glossy office block Babylon.
Yeah.
The tower that is famous because it was torn down, basically.
Yeah, exactly. When it was first built, actually, there were already people in the press making references to Constant Neuenhaus's project. So they were calling this the Whore of Babylon or something. So this was seen as a kind of capitalist appropriation of his project already back in 1970. Wow. It was Paul Donker Davis wrote an article in there. Can't remember which newspaper about it. So,
can you tell us a little bit about the project, about Radio New Babylon?
I was looking at public spaces and art in public space, and I was really interested in spaces which are kind of what they call POPs, so privately owned public spaces, and what you could and what you couldn't do there. You know, this is a case in point because we're not actually supposed to be recording here. Mm. You're not allowed to film or record, or I'm surprised we've got away with it this long. So the idea was, how could we do something in a space like this in a kind of secret way, but it, which let people have some kind of experience of artworks or music works. And I was already working with these kind of app-based augmented reality almost, but audio apps where you can place, you can locate audio in particular places and let the listener move through those spaces and listen to things. It's like a spatial composition idea in a way. I thought, well, it would be interesting to make some pieces for this place. And then I thought, why should I do that? I mean, it was something like, I'm not interested in doing it myself, really. I was more interested in how other people would respond. Also because of this kind of mismatch between the idea of New Babylon being a city of play and this place, which is where you can't play, really. So it was, I thought, well, I'm just going to invite people I know, people who I know knew the building as well, so people from The Hague, but also different sound artists I knew, also international people. And I just asked them to make a short, if they feel like it, yeah, if you feel like it, make a short piece and send it to me and I'll place it and then we'll have this kind of, it's like an album, actually. It's kind of like an album, but you have to be here to listen to it. Some people came here actually and made recordings and then did things with the recordings. And other people did something somewhere completely different and just put that there. Some people were more playful with the kind of composition method. So there are some people who've really played with locating different sounds in different places on different sides of the building. Most people just made a piece that, yeah, you could listen to it either inside or around, depending on what you want to do. If you want to be warm or you want to have fresh air. But it's grown to there are now about 30 pieces, and there are still some people making things.
In eerdere werken van Bennett, zoals bijvoorbeeld de Zuidas-symfonie, speelt de verhouding privaat-publiek eigendom ook een belangrijke rol. We vragen hem of dit een thema is dat vaker terugkomt in zijn werk.
As an artist, if you're confronted with this kind of thing anyway in your work, when you're asked to do things or invited to do things in certain places, then you come across these the restrictions or the differences between where you're allowed to do certain things and who you have to deal with. And I'm also really interested in this idea of who is the city for, or who are buildings for, and who makes decisions about that.
Maybe a bit of a sidetrack, but did Constant Nieuwenhuis's ideas, theories and plans about New Babylon, did they have a sonic component as well?
They did.
Okay.
And he was, I was reading a long time ago about him doing his presentations, and it would always said, yeah, that he did these lectures with slideshows and played soundtracks, but it was never clear what these soundtracks were. Then suddenly there was this moment this last year when I was doing this research into Constant Nieuwenhuis, and I had contact with the Fondation Constant. And by chance, they said, well, I think I asked about this. And they said, well, we don't really know, but we've got some tapes lying around here and we don't know what they are. So I said, I'll have a look at them. So I borrowed these tapes and we digitized them at the Institute of Sonology where I work. And they're super interesting because some of it is not quite clear what it is. Seems to be material to make something with rather than finished pieces, but some of it is clearly a kind of finished long collage. So it's a collage of city sounds, music, voices, some kind of simple tape manipulation, you know, very speed and playing things backwards and
au niveau des vies, et maintenant avec une possibilité d'évoluer. Il faut déjà, c'est contours de la lutte entre la société actuelle et les forces toujours à détruire, toujours en harmonie et gênement, toujours en construction sur les rouages ou en lieu, la nouvelle condition de département. Ceci, à titre d'expérience, comme de propagande, tout le reste appartient au passé.
Les situationnistes et les écoutants du mouvement pour les loisirs d'aujourd'hui prononcent contre le
changement. Les situationnistes envisagent la critique culturelle du point de vue de la totalité comme méthode de construction expérimentale de la vie quotidienne, mais développable en permanence avec l'extension des radios et la disparition de la division du travail, à commencer par la division du travail. La conception que nous avons d'une situation construite ne se borne pas à un emploi unitaire de manière artistique concourante à une ambiance si grande que puisse être l'expansion spatio-temporelle et la force de cette ambiance.
Yeah, it was really interesting to discover that. Also because you had an idea of this city, it's incredibly noisy. He also talks about the ambiences would be controlled and played with by creative teams, he says.
Oh, really?
I guess to encourage people to play. So he had a kind of, there was a role in New Babylon for people actually making not just sound but also visual art and or, I mean, it wasn't art anymore by this point. It was about controlling the ambiences of the city, I think, rather than being a kind of autonomous artwork. It would be part of the ambience of the whole city. But when you listen to these collages, it's like, yeah, car crashes and free jazz and some backwards, you know, I don't know, some backwards comedian talking, and there's all this kind of weird stuff, lots of machine noises.
Not harmonic.
Not at all. Yeah, it's much more improvised. His sound world is much more kind of improvisatory and chaotic and open in a way that I think he wanted his city to be, you know. I'm not sure it would be a nice place to live. If you listen to that, you might think, Jesus, I don't want to, you know, I don't really want to be there. But I think that's really interesting also to think about the links between how people relate to each other in music, and especially with improvised music, and how people relate to each other socially and politically. It's something that's really interesting, I think.
We verlaten New Babylon om een wandeling te maken door het centrum van Den Haag.
I'm always surprised if you look at, about 10 or 15 years ago, every large European city had to make a noise map if it was above a certain population. It was something the gemeentes, they all had to do this. And if you look at the one of Den Haag, then, I guess every city is kind of the same. You tend to think, okay, the center of town is kind of busy and it must be noisy, but there's often right in the center places where it's actually really quiet, and you can see that. I mean, these noise maps are usually not measured, they're just calculated, so they see where the traffic is, how the traffic moves and the times of day and that kind of thing, and they sort of calculate it. But it's true that right in the center of The Hague there are places which are really like oase, you know, oasis. It sees oases in the soundscape. We could walk down that way because this is quite an interesting acoustic down here. Even before those really big buildings were built, people would complain about the wind here.
Oh, really?
This kind of tunnel. I'm trying to remember what they call it. They have some kind of over-the-top name for this entrance to the city. When you come from Central Station and you walk into the city, yeah, well, it's something like that, you know. It's a windgat, basically. It's a wind tunnel that you get stuck in. And now it's even worse with these buildings. And I guess this is in a way why I got into, I don't know, listening to cities and doing things with recording cities, is that when I first started making my own music, I guess, then I made a lot of recordings in the city simply because it was the easiest way to get interesting sounds. I didn't have any complicated synthesizers or computers or anything, so it was like cassette recorders and tape recorders, and so it was kind of like sound collecting, and especially these kind of industrial sounds, drones and machines and this kind of thing. I made loads of recordings of that, and I think that's probably how I got interested in really listening to the city, listening to it first as a kind of source of musical material.
And now, how's it different now?
Well, it's similar. It's the same, because I still also listen to things as musical material. But I think I've come to. I think you go through different, because there's so many different ways of listening. And I think an artist or a musician working with these kinds of sounds, you also go through different kinds of ways of working with it, you know? So I think I started off, yeah, looking for material to do things with, or to sample, or to, you know, to work with. And then I became more interested in the kind of longer term listening and longer recording. So listening to the rhythms, how a city changes in across a whole day, or that kind of thing. And then I get interested in, yeah, the sound of spaces, you know, listening to sounds as how sound reveals space. When the tram goes ding here, you know, it echoes in a particular way. And
sirens fitted to the emergency vehicles in Brussels have always been clearly present in the sonic environment. But since the recent terrorist attacks, their presence is almost ubiquitous. Like the calls of a bird or other territorial animal, the sirens proclaim, "I am here. This street is mine." Of course, this is exactly the intention, a proclamation of the ownership of, or the right to use, the roadway above any other user. In claiming the street, though, they perform a double territorialization by also dominating a large portion of the sonic spectrum. The sirens, especially those that sweep up and down in frequency, cover a large part of our functional hearing range, particularly that which we use for listening to speech. The sweeps start usually at about 500 to 600 Hz in order for them to be heard clearly above the rumble of traffic. The upper fundamental frequency is usually about 1500 Hz, but the harmonics or overtones audible when in line of sight of the vehicle go up to about 8000 Hz. The volume that the sirens produce, 110 decibels, measured at 3.5 meter in front of the vehicle, is apparently necessary to allow them to be heard over in-car sound systems. Dit was een fragment van de publicatie Siren Song van Bennett. Dit werk onderzoekt de plek van sirenes in de sonische omgeving door middel van tekst en beeld. Opvallend in het werk van Bennett is dat geluid zowel muzikaal als politiek wordt benaderd. Soms één van de twee, soms allebei tegelijk.
Like I said, you can listen in different ways as well. So you, these different modes of listening to to a sound as being a siren, as being, I mean, you can listen to it as a musical thing, or you can listen to it as a way of hearing the architecture of a place, but you can also hear it as what it's supposed to be, which is get out of the way. Get out of the way, there's an ambulance coming. Or you can listen to it as the sign, a kind of symbolically as you know, the police are again going down to the park to get rid of all the homeless people there or something. So, you know, it works on all these different levels. And I definitely like to play with these different levels and go, I'm interested in all of them, I suppose. I'm interested in too many things. And so I kind of move between them. And sometimes, it's sometimes I also just like to make music, actually. So it goes, you know, between these, this sort of journalistic or documentary approach is really interesting, and I do work with that as well. But sometimes I can kind of switch into this musical mode, which I think is also a very interesting way of listening, because it's perhaps a more, I don't know, it's not really distanced, but it's a more non-judgmental, perhaps, way of listening to the sounds around you, because you're listening in a completely different way, in an abstract way, and instead of them being signs for something else, or something that annoys you because it stops you hearing something else, or, you know, that kind of thing. It's, yeah, but it's something that I'm always thinking about, and I don't know where I put myself right in that.
And depends on the work.
It depends on the work, and it depends on, you know, different things. I tend to work on, in kind of projects that take a longer time, and where different things come out of different works or events or whatever they are come out of that. So for instance, that thing in Brussels, that siren song that you mentioned, was at the same time as also creating a sound walk in Brussels and doing this project with the filters, so these objects to listen through to the city, which in a way is more musical to my imagination. You know, I imagine that as being a kind of more musical thing in a way.
Met de akoestische filters van Justin Bennett zijn we aan het einde gekomen van deze eerste episode van Radicaal Geroezemoes. De volgende episode is Resonanties van Verlies. Radicaal Geroezemoes is een productie van Trashlinie in samenwerking met Recto Verso, Gonzo Circus en Collateral. Trashlinie is Sjoerd Leijten en Roel Griffioen.